This week in Retronauts, we shift off automatic to manual. Everyone, welcome to Retronauts episode 410, unless something changes. I am Jeremy Parrish, and we're recording live again in... Do we call this a studio? Do we lie? Do we lie to the listeners and pretend that we are in a studio? It's a hotel room.
Well, but you're showing the video, right?
No. The video, like, this is not good TV here.
Everyone, I'm literally looking at Jeremy Parrish right now. Yes. Like, looking right in my face. Eye. It's getting a little awkward.
I could reach over and punch Frank, but I wouldn't, because why... Why would I punch a beloved guest on Retronauts?
That's me, by the way.
Frank, who are you?
I'm Frank. Hi, I'm Frank Zaffaldi. I'm the founder and co-director of the Video Game History Foundation. You've probably heard me on the show at some point in the past. Is that enough? Should I keep going?
Yeah, sure. That's great.
Great.
Who else do we have here
in the studio? Hi, it's Jason Wilson, the managing editor over GameSpeed and the old part in the room today.
Not by much.
By enough.
Are you actually older than me?
Yes, I'm 46.
I'm 46.
Wait a second. Oh. The same age.
Face off.
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
March 75.
You're old. March 75? No, I'm older. October 74.
Okay.
Oh.
So Jason's the old fart. I'm the young whippersnapper. And that's finally, better. We have
and Frank is ageless.
Frank is ageless. And there's, of course, the Canadian, where time is like, I think the exchange rate is like 0.8 right now.
I don't understand time. All I know is, yes, we are in different time zones, but I'm happy to be here nonetheless. I'm also very happy to not be the oldest person in the room for a change. Oh, by the way, this is Nadia.
Yeah, I was going to say, I would love for you to have a name. Do they give you those
I have
in
a name.
Canada?
My name is Nadia Oxford. I am the co-host of the Acts of the Blood God podcast, and we also have me hosting the Charlene Dropouts, which is a Final Fantasy XIV podcast. So yeah, I'm busy these days with my voice.
All right. And this is maybe going to be a slightly loopy episode, but I think it'll be fun because maybe it's going to be slightly loopy. This is a patron request episode from Jeff Vlasic, who quite a while back, a long time ago actually, said, I would love for you, the Retronauts, to record an episode about video game manuals. It's actually taken a long time to come together because it's such an ambiguous request. Like, what does that mean to talk about game manuals? And so we're just going to kind of wing it, because really it's a pretty big topic. And I think anyone who owned video games when they were younger and grew up playing video games has a lot of memories of manuals, and they are kind of retro at this point. Like, most games do not ship with manuals to speak of, certainly not physical manuals. It's become kind of a boutique thing. And, so, you know, if that's not retro, I don't know what is. So it's a great topic for Retronauts. Thank you, Jeff. And you can't see it because this is an audio podcast, but we have a lot of show and tell going on here just for kind of reference. So whenever we bring out a manual to swap and share and discuss, we're going to kind of describe it physically and explain what it's like. So hopefully that will be, you know, evoking images of the mind, the theater of the mind, so to speak. And we'll give those of you listening on the audio side of things a great sense of what's happening here in the studio. But this is, you know, an episode that does take advantage of the fact that we can safely record face-to-face for the first time in a long time.
And get your shots!
Yes, please be vaccinated so that you can also record with us. wear a mask in public so that you can stay safe and record with us. I don't know if you're going to record with us, but you can record with people in person. It's great. You get to show video game manuals to each other. I love that. Anyway, I'm going to start by asking, what is your first memory, your first real memory of having a video game manual and experiencing it and thinking, oh, this is interesting or cool, or this, you know, this means something?
So for me, it was with Intellivision. And the first one was baseball. I brought a printout of it because, you know, that's been lost to the ages. But what was really cool about Intellivision manuals was, because you had a manual and it was very small, there wasn't much to them,
So you've got that printed on letter size paper, two pages per sheet, but I don't think that's actual resolution.
Yeah, this is larger.
Actual resolution. These things were like pocket guides.
Yeah, that's like the large print Bible version of the Intellivision.
But what
baseball.
Was interesting about these was you got not only the manuals, but how to put in the insert and where the insert was over everything.
Right. Oh, that controller.
Yeah,
I don't like controller, that for the ColecoVision.
Yeah, the controller that, you know, killed hands.
Well, and also I think the insert in itself was kind of like a manual.
In a way.
Yeah.
In a way. And so that's what I always thought was really neat about Nintendo, Intellivision manuals. Now, they were small. They didn't have much story in them. They didn't have much anything besides, this is how it goes in. This is what this does. This is what this button does. This is how you put the overlay in and stuff like that. But, you know, this is a game from, I think, 81. So maybe even a little earlier. So, you know, there wasn't much in manual writing at that point. And one of the first beefy manuals I ever remember, and this is, again, another printout, is the Ultima manual.
Ah.
Because this was Richard Garriott's, and this was, you know, after his A Calibeth game, which was sold in little baggies that he kind of assembled himself. And so it had lots of art and story and writing in it. Mm-hmm. And it was very different than what you would get with an Atari and a television manual in those days. You didn't get much of this kind of stuff. Not even in the AD&D games on the Intellivision.
Well, this is for grown-ups, okay? Not for them whippersnappers with the television.
Yeah, but
whippersnappers are Nintendo.
There are a lot of kids who played Ultima, too. Well,
sure.
Some. So,
but they thought they were adults.
Yeah. It's just such a different thing when you look at, you know, these are the same era, just about. And this was before, you know, you've got all kinds of things like copy protection.
Right.
In manuals with PC games and stuff like that. So it's a little earlier than that, but it was very personalized with some PC games. Other PC games at this time were just, you know, oh, it's just the basics. This is how you move. This is how you do this. This is how you do that. But in those very early days, you know, some people like Gary Oates went out and made them very personal.
Yeah, I mean, if you look back at the history of video games, in the 1970s, there wasn't really much cause for people to need manuals because you had either very simple arcade-style experiences, so you got those Intellivision-style manuals, where it was basically like, here's how you move your tank around, here's how you shoot, you know, the cannon on your tank, here's what will happen when you shoot the cannon on your tank, here's the scoring system. Or else, you know, the really complex games, things like precursors to Ultima or precursors to Infocom games, those were made kind of at an institutional level for people who, you know, they weren't commercial releases at that point. They were made kind of in collaboration with academic people, you know, in colleges, and they all just kind of contributed to the games as much as played them. And there was this sense of discovery, like sit down and figure stuff out. It wasn't until gaming really kind of went commercial in the end of the 70s that there was the need to say, like, here's how you play this. And it wasn't until, you know, these more adventurous games came out, these more expansive games like Ultima and Infocom's games, that there was a need to say, here's why you're doing all this stuff. Because, you know, there wasn't a lot you could say within the game itself when your game was 64 kilobytes.
What's really interesting about the Intellivision manuals, and you might have to correct me here versus Atari, is you could see that Intellivision had a style book for how they wanted all their manuals designed. And they followed them. They didn't necessarily use the same fonts all the time, but they had the same layout and progress, and this is where you put in the insert sheet, and this is how you use the arrows to put in the insert sheet.
Well, that's because no third parties were making Intellivision games. I mean, a couple were, but, you know, it was mostly Mattel-controlled, whereas Atari had people making games without their dang permission over at Activision over there. But I want to go back to the 70s stuff and say that, you know, that if we're talking the earliest home games, those manuals were essentially like, here's how you hook Pong up to the TV, right?
Here's how you install on your Apple II.
Right, exactly. But also, like, if we're talking 70s computer games, those would mostly be type-in programs, right? So, like, you might have, you know, David All's 101 Basic Computer Games book or you know, even Issues of Creative Computing or something. And there would be some sense of instructions, but it'd be more like a description of what the game is that you're about to type in, what it's actually going to be like. And it'd just be, you know, very basic, no pun intended, because basic is the programming language. It's like Space Invaders, but you're not a ship, you're a car. You know?
Right. And, yeah, and even if you look at a lot of these early 80s manuals, like the Intellivision manuals that Jason showed, a lot of those are not so much like, here is how you play the game, here's how the game works. It's more like, here's how you interact with the game.
Yeah.
Because controls had not consolidated. There was no single rubric for, this is how interface works. We hadn't gotten to, like, the D-pad plus A button jumps and B button does another thing. So it was much more about, like, you've got all these commands here, all these different buttons. You need to know what these are actually going to do. And then, you know, with baseball, I think something like that, they kind of relied on the fact that this is a video game adaptation of a real world sport. So they could, you know, kind of lean on the fact that you sort of knew how baseball worked. Well, and it's really more of a question of like, what do the buttons actually do?
So I'm gonna jump in here and actually say that the manual for baseball, which I'm looking at right now, right on the cover, I'm just gonna read it. Baseball, traditional game of the United States, is similar to cricket and rounders.
did George Plimpton write this?
And also, it's copyright 1979, so we are in the 70s.
All right.
We are on topic here. The playing
Bring
field,
out the wood paneling.
Called the diamond, is laid out with three canvas bags called bases and a rubber slab set. So it's like, it's actually telling you what baseball is.
Yeah, there's your instructions.
So
we got to fill these words.
I guess
somehow.
I'm wrong. It's really started from zero.
At least in this case, right? I doubt if you go get like real sports baseball or something for the Atari. I doubt Atari's explaining what the sport of baseball
what baseball is.
But yeah, you have to read that in George Plimpton's voice.
Yeah, I don't remember his voice.
Baseball, a traditional game of the United States, is similar to cricket and rounders. That sort of New England accent. Yep.
My only frame of reference for George Plimpton is the Intellivision commercials, yeah, right. And that's what those sound like. So, good job.
Thing I thought was really interesting you brought up was there was no consolidation around control schemes. You think, look, the Atari controller was different than the Intellivisions, which was different than the ColecoVisions. Mm-hmm. You look over at Apple PC gaming at the time, you had, you know, either like an adaptation of an Atari controller, or you had this other controller that was like the stick in the middle with a little button, and then
yes,
it had these two different,
we had that.
Yeah, and then it had these two different sliders to do the tension on the stick.
Yes.
Or you just use the keyboard.
Or you just use a keyboard.
There were so many different choices. But yeah, standardization was still a ways away. So a lot of early manuals were just like, here is what the dang buttons do. And, you know, if you look back to the earliest arcade video game instructions, it's Pong. And that consists of avoid missing ball for high score.
That's still the greatest instructions ever.
It's so to the point. Yeah. Everything else you just kind of figure out on your own. But there's just the one button, but eventually, or the knob.
Yeah.
But eventually you play with it and you realize, oh, like, this does stuff. It works differently depending on how I use it. I can move at different speeds. I can hit the ball at different angles. I can put English on it. It left a lot to kind of the player to discover. And arcade games always stayed pretty simple. I mean, even if you look at like a Street Fighter 2 or Mortal Kombat cabinet, like they have a lot of text on them, but it still amounts to like three paragraphs of text total for these games that would have manual, you know, strategy guides, an inch thick released for them with exhaustive layouts of, you know, here's what these specific button combinations do. But so much of that was just about discovery, about like, you know, even the bragging rights of saying like, I know how to do this combination, this command with this character. I'm not going to tell you that because that's my that's my ace in the hole. Like, I can do Chun-Li's super kick and you don't know how to do Ryu's fireball. So I'm going to win this match and I'm not going to give you the secret.
Well, and that game design is, you know, it's classic game design pratfall where the designers assumed that all the special moves would be these like deep secrets that no one really knew. And then it just became how you actually play that game and win is to do the special moves.
I don't know if that's so much with Street Fighter 2. I mean, you know, the idea of sharing information communally was so built in, especially in Japanese arcades.
Yeah. I could be thinking of one, actually.
Yeah,
one. It was probably Street Fighter 1, I could see, they didn't think people would actually like use these moves.
Right.
They were deep secrets. Am I supposed to share my first manual memory,
please,
at this point?
Yes,
okay. Please.
So when I was little, we did have an Atari in the house, but as we did back then, the packaging and manuals went in the trash probably on day two.
No.
So my first manual that I recall would actually be Super Mario Brothers. I got my NES. Specifically, I guess it'd be the Mario Duck Hunt combo manual. But my first actual memory, and Jeremy, maybe you can recall the wording better than I can, was something along the lines of, when you kick the Koopa shell off the screen, sometimes it disappears. And it says something like, it's because of Koopa magic.
Right. And also, also it explained that, you know, it has a little bit of story and talks about how the citizens of the Mushroom Kingdom were transformed into
these blocks
and
that you're destroying. Yeah,
specifically,
what's a horsehair plant? What the hell is that?
There aren't even horsehair plants in the game. It's very strange. Like, where are all these purported Mushroom Kingdom denizens?
It is a very, this is actually something I wrote for usgamer.net back in the day. I wrote about how it's kind of a haunting manual in strange ways. Like, I don't want to talk over Frank, but
no, you're not.
I do.
Please.
Okay. Basically, my first memory of an instruction book that I remember really well, and this was Super Mario Brothers 3. And this goes into something, Jeremy, you were saying earlier about how games became more marketable. I think as that happened, their instruction manuals became much more marketable as well. Super Mario Brothers 3 had a story in it. It had a lot of really great art that I still think is fantastic. It was just really a pleasure to pore over. And that's the first one I remember really getting into. And then I kind of went backwards and saw the Super Mario Brothers manual for the first time and was just like, why is it so janky, for lack of a better term? Why is it just hand-drawn? This Mario looks strange. This dialect is very weird. What are they talking about? The Mushroom Kingdoms? What the hell is a horsehair plant? So... yeah, that was kind of I just found that was like a really interesting juxtaposition. And the Mario 2 manual, of course, is more like the Mario 3 manual where you have a whole story and Mario goes on a picnic and it all goes terribly wrong. Yeah, so I just thought that was an interesting way for the series to start out. Just that really kind of really strange, dark narrative and the illustrations that are all in like those jagged pixels. It's a strange book.
I don't know what a horsehair plant is.
I don't think anybody does.
I always assumed it was like a cat of nine tails.
You know, okay, all right.
Not a cat of nine tails, a cat tail.
Yeah, that's right.
Cat tail, yeah.
Right, not
the whip. Yeah. I mean, maybe, I don't know. Nature's whip.
The torture / pleasure device. Not that.
Ooh.
I mean, there's a lot of dungeons in Super Mario Brothers.
That's a good point.
That's true.
Oh, boy.
Anyway, maybe, Nadia, what was your first formative memory of a video game manual?
Well, there was the Mario 3 one that I just talked about, but I also want to kind of mention that growing up, we rented a lot of our games. And I know when you were renting games, you could have like kind of a crapshoot. You might get a manual, you might not. The place we rented from, which was literally called Independent Video, they always had manuals and they were always photocopied. And I remember just being absolutely blown away by the manual for Dragon Warrior 3. Because that was a guidebook. Back then, they were really, really trying to get Americans into Japanese RPGs. So they would really give you a whole book that says, here's how to play the game. Please buy it. So Dragon Quest III had a whole like manual that was just written really well. It had like charts full of illustrations of weapons and armor. And one thing that's extremely charming about Dragon Warrior manuals in general is that it's hard to explain, but they take Toriyama's art and they westernize it in a way where if you compare the two side by side, you will see the characters in the exact same poses, except one is Toriyama style and in America it's like big beefy, you know, Western hero stereotype. And I think the box art for Dragon Warrior 2 is glorious, as is the box art for Dragon Warrior 3. But that was just getting those big manuals and seeing how much love went into them. Like for me, Dragon Quest 3 was a very, very formative game as a writer. And I feel like the manual had some hand in that.
I remember renting the first Final Fantasy and its manual, somebody had drawn a dick in it.
Of course they did. Mm-hmm. My Mario 3 manual, my husband's very, very picky about preserving things and keeping them in boxes and keeping them, you know, nice and tight. But I grew up in a house with two brothers. And he was looking through my old manual collection. He sees my manual for Mario 3, and he turns to a picture where Roy, the Koopaling, is saying, "Wow, this Mario sure is tough. I hope we can stop him." And someone, either myself or my brother, had taken a red crayon and written in really scrawling childish words, "Oh shit," like coming out of his mouth. So my husband saw this and he's like, "How could you do that?" And I'm like, "What do you want? We were idiot kids."
Yeah, you weren't thinking about the collector's value, Nadia.
I was certainly not, especially when I cut up my Final Fantasy III box for an art project. Mm. I was not thinking about the implications of the future.
Yeah.
I'm sorry, everyone. I'm sorry, Frank. I know that was painful.
I threw all mine away. What are you apologizing me for? I don't care.
So I can't remember if it was either the Final Fantasy or the manual for Faxanadu. I remember it was this really big and thick and gorgeous.
Faxanadu's manual was a standard size. I think it was a little taller.
Yeah.
Basically, the size format you got for Super NES manuals would occasionally show up ahead of Super NES as the manuals for role-playing games.
And yeah, they even get a special foam block on the bottom styrofoam that had a little cutout for the rest of the manual to fit in.
Yeah, and that's something that even happened on Game Boy. I didn't bring in Dragon Warrior or Final Fantasy because I didn't feel like digging them up, but Final Fantasy Legend 2, all these early RPGs on Nintendo systems, and also Sega, like the Phantasy Star manuals were chunkers.
Well, Phantasy Star 2 came with the guidebook, you know, like as a manual.
But there was this idea that American kids would just have no idea what to do with these role-playing games. There's words and stuff, like, so weird.
Reading.
So Nintendo and their, especially Nintendo, but some of their partners would publish games with manuals that were oversized and would be strategy guides. And, you know, Game Boy manuals were, like, very tiny NES manuals. They were basically, you know, kind of landscape format, long and short. Long on the horizontal axis, short on the vertical. Mm-hmm. But when you got the RPGs like Final Fantasy Legend, then you got this full square booklet that was actually the size of the Game Boy box. And this would become the standard size format for DS manuals a decade later, more than a decade later. But until then, it was reserved for very special games. And looking at Final Fantasy Legend 2, it goes into so much detail. This is an 80-page manual that has lots of illustrations.
It has
the basics of like how to use the controller, but for the most part, it's things like, you know, what are the character classes you can choose? Mm-hmm. What do these different characters do? How do you come to terms with the mechanics? Who are these characters who will sometimes join your party? How does the world map work? And it's just, you know, very elaborate. It gives you a walkthrough. Let's see, the first town, Shrine of Isis.
Yeah, I know that the walkthrough in the original Final Fantasy Legend manual it was narrated like it was a fantasy story. It was really interesting.
Yeah, it takes you all the way into the third world of the game, the Giant's World.
Right.
Mm-hmm. So that's, you know, that's roughly halfway through the game or a third of the way through the game. It's really, you know, the idea is that it's teaching you how to play, teaching you how to function in a role-playing game, as it also like lays out the details of the instructions. And
this might be slightly off topic. I would argue that it's not, but you know, Nintendo conveyed that a lot through Nintendo Power. Mm-hmm. So, you know, when they're introducing something like Dragon Warrior, you know, they're essentially trying to introduce the JRPG to the US, and their Nintendo Power spread as a result is something like 16 pages just explaining, just, you know, it's not like a strategy guide to your new game. It's more like, here's what this kind of game is like. Right. And you know, and they went even further with Final Fantasy, where that month's Nintendo Power was literally a strategy guide to Final Fantasy to teach you the language of this genre that they were really trying to force on us, rightfully so. And then,
justice.
They failed twice and then canceled the third one.
So meanwhile, while this was going on, you'd start getting books for like 1986 Might and Magic, which was a very big RPG at the time on PC. And so I've got a big chunky manual here. The manual itself, if memory serves, is about a little taller than what Zelda was.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, a little wider, but it was pretty thick.
Was it one of the spiral-bound ones? Or
no, it wasn't spiral-bound, but the spiral-bounds would be coming in pretty soon.
Yeah.
And I brought one of those. But with this, you had to type in so many different keyboard commands. So it gives you the commands for, like, going to town or, you know, what kind of class you want. And as you can see, you know, because New World at the time was a new company, they didn't really have much in terms of graphic layout. These are just the printouts for the manual.
Mm-hmm.
and
Times New Roman.
Is that just a file that came on the disk or something?
Barry, read me.
It had some art on the cover, of course, and then it came with a map. And not a cloth map. This was just a paper map. And, you know, and then you have attack commands, so you have to enter. And, you know, there's no mouse with this game. And you go into even to where, like, how do you cast your spells? Because you gotta have the name, plus you need to know, you know, what kind of... Do you have the right equipment with you? Some spells in Might Magic you need to have gems with or not. And there are several different classes. And so these things got big and honking very fast. This was the map that came with it.
Yeah. Awesome.
What comes to mind for me that I don't think they were doing there, but they were certainly doing in stuff like Wasteland, was that the manual actually served as essentially disk storage space for the plot.
Right.
So
exactly.
So there were you know, you would be playing a game like Wasteland, and you'd get to a new area or something, and the game would literally tell you, like, oh, go read this page of the manual to know what this guy just said to you, because there's not enough room on this disc for us to store all this text. So that's something that we never saw on the console side, certainly.
Well, not to that degree, but there were certainly some console games that really kind of went all out with the manual. Zelda 2 comes to mind, where it opens with, like, 4 or 6 pages of backstory about, you know, the princess, the original Princess Zelda, and how her evil brother cast a spell on her because he was possessed by a dark wizard. And there's an old woman named Impa who gives Link his quest and reveals that he has the Triforce mark on his hand.
Yeah.
And he goes forth to strike down. None of that's in the game.
Right.
In the game, you start out, you're standing in front of Zelda, who's asleep on a cairn, and that's it. It's like, doon, 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 go on your adventure. And so you start out. But there's like all this exposition in the manual.
But you don't need that
say,
exposition for the game, though.
What's that?
You don't need that exposition to play the game.
You don't.
Which is the big difference here.
But to understand what the hell you're doing, like, wait, didn't I save Zelda? Why am I going to save another Zelda?
I didn't question it as a kid. I was like, all right, Zelda's doing a Sleeping Beauty. Let's go.
Here's a little bit of interesting trivia. In Canada, the instruction booklets have to be part French, part English.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't realize for many, 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 many years until my husband showed me his Zelda 2 book that our Canadian version was truncated to fit the French.
Oh.
So we're missing some of the story. We're missing some of the pictures. We're missing a lot. And I was just like, wow, I am furious about missing out on, because it was a great instruction booklet. It's another one of my favorites.
Even manuals are hit by the exchange rate. It's terrible.
Exactly. There you go. But it's such a great manual. Like, it talks about, like, the enemies having to defeat Link and sprinkle his blood in the ashes of Ganon. Like, that's metal. That's really, really cool to read when you're, like, 8 years old.
So, as for my formative experience, let's do some backstory here. I pulled up the oldest manual I could find, in my collection at least, of things that I'm covering for videos someday. So this is Super Golf for the Epic Super Cassette Vision. It's a very tiny manual. It's 16 pages, and they crammed this thing with information. It's like sports stats. It's like, how can you even read this unless you're far nearsighted like me? But it's interesting because it gives you, you know, an explanation of the controls, and kind of a screen layout and, hey, here's what you need to know about golf clubs, like some basics about golf clubs.
And then we have the hole, par, and how many
There's even a section called meters. Local rules.
Well, and I think it goes through each hole, right?
Like, it does. It shows you the course guide is what this is called. And it tells you what the par is, how far you have to drive to get to the hole for all 18 holes. This is 16 games, tiny pages.
Some golf games in the 80s had stuff like that too.
But they fit all of this into the size of a business, 16 business cards basically. Or actually 8 business cards front and back.
What year?
This would have been 1984, 85.
This is really cool.
It's very old. Around the same time, you also had Sega's SG-1000 or the SC-3000. So I have a manual here for Zaxxon, which is bigger. Mm. It's like, I guess this is 3x5, and it's about 24 pages long. But it's more elaborate. It's got, a kind of mimeograph-looking style to it. It's blue ink on white, but it's got the cover art. It has the usual, like, hey, here's what systems you can run this on. They have to give a whole page to this because of all the weird cross-compatibility with Sega's machines. The 32X was not a new thing for them. But then you open it up and it shows the character list, which is all spaceships and satellites and things like that.
But actually, this does bring up something that manuals provided that we haven't talked about, which is like, a closer look at the graphics in the game as drawings. Drawings.
Yes.
Yeah, like, I mean, you have... Oh, I guess your ship is called Zaxxon. I always thought it was the robot. But apparently in this version, Zaxxon is your ship.
Is this canon?
I don't know. I mean, this is by Sega. This is their own game, so I guess they know. But it has like a special page on how you play it with the computer keyboard if you use the SC-3000, how you use the three or four different controllers that were available on the different models at that point. And then it actually gets to like screen layouts, explanations of scoring and how you move. Let's see, what else? It's basically a guide on what you're supposed to do on each stage, more drawings of missiles and launch bases and the spaceships you have to fight in the intermission stages. Lots of screenshots, pretty good clean screenshots too. Kind of impressive. I don't think those are just drawings either. They look like screenshots. So good job, Sega. Just a lot of breakdowns. And then there's an old man, a strange looking old man who tells you, they definitely used a framemeister. An old man who's like, hey, here's your safety instructions.
I'm a scientist. I know what I'm doing.
That's funny.
He looks more like Colonel Sanders, actually. He's got a monocle and a big droopy beard.
I wonder if he's like a Sega support character.
He might be. This is Sega Sanshiro's grandfather. Anyway, so that's a more, like, this is the kind of manual you were seeing on systems like ColecoVision at the same time. And a bigger version of a Famicom manual. But I was going to say that the first time I ever really noticed a manual, like I read the Mario manual and things like that, but the first time I really noticed a manual was Metroid's manual. For NES. And I think this is the point where Nintendo actually kind of recalibrated what it was doing with its games. Because the NES manuals for the first year or two, they were all just like simple black and white. Mm. You pretty much could have photocopied them and they would look the same. The only color was like the game logo. Actually just the game title.
Yep.
You can't even call that a logo. It's Helvetica.
It's technically a logo,
but every game had the same logo with different letters. But that was it, just on the cover. But with Metroid, Zelda, Kid Icarus all hitting around the same time, you had much more elaborate content. Mm-hmm. And this one, does the thing where it gives you a lot of backstory that's not hinted at in the game. The game gives you like, 5 sentences on the title screen that's like, go find the horrible space creature Metroid that destroyed the mechanical life vein mother brain.
I've never seen this somehow.
Oh, yeah? That's with the Galactic Federation and the Council of Aliens. Yeah. And
really cool.
Then there's Samus. Yeah, Samus, he's the coolest. He's the best bounty hunter. He's going to go fight a space lobster and space jellyfish.
And go get drinks with the boys after.
Yeah. Oh, absolutely.
It says that right there.
But this one, you got the controls and everything, but it's just very colorful and full of detail. Like, the typography is not great, It's got, you know, just random artwork thrown in there. There's like Samus looking quizzical, like twice. I don't know why, but it gives you a It gives you a simple map of how the game world is laid out. It's not like an actual map, but it just shows you like here are the different zones that you will need to explore.
This really looks like Fun Club News.
Yeah, yeah, it's very much in that same style. So you know, it gives you a breakdown of enemies and the powers you can collect. And then kind of at the end, it's like, hey, here's the final boss. Who could that be? It's a question mark. But it's full of little cute cartoon drawings. And
this manual's great.
It gives you like...
Here's some more art for no reason in the back.
Here's where you can write the password, the 24-character password.
Yeah, put that right in there. Yeah.
I'm sure kids were doing that just fine.
Now, did the Japanese manual look like that?
Let's find out.
Well, I'm glad you asked, Jason Wilson, because as it happens, I have the Family Computer Disk System version of the Metroid manual. And the answer is yes. All of the contents of the American manual are taken from the disk system. And I think this was where you get the big jump off in Nintendo's approach to manuals, because their Famicom manuals, all the way through Super Mario Brothers, the end of 1985, are very plain, very simple, black and white.
Well, I think our American Super Mario manual is also the Japanese manual.
Yeah, pretty much.
Translated.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah. I didn't know that.
And in early 1986, early 86, Nintendo was like, hey, we're doing the disk system. Now the Famicom is better. And that came with it a new format because it was on a 3-inch diskette. There are these compact little packages, and that determined the size of the manual, which fits perfectly into the package, which is the same size as the disk. But they crammed these things with content. I mean, this manual, it's 3 inches square, but it's 54 pages. It's got like a nice, perfect bound cardstock cover, glossy. It's got stickers inside. Oh my God.
Ooh,
This was a sealed copy of Metroid when I opened
it
and destroyed its value.
They're disc side stickers.
But there's also like a Metroid and Ridley and Samus.
Oh, you're right. Yeah. I didn't see that.
Yeah, these are disc side stickers, but they're more elaborate versions of the stickers that came on the disc itself. And there's, like little illustrations all throughout the story. Like all the content that you see in the American version comes over. Obviously, some things have been changed, like the Japanese controller versus the American.
Right.
But, Nintendo took this opportunity with the disk system to say, let's really upgrade our game. Let's really rethink how we present our games and present the information about the games. And so you get all this lore, you get all the like information about enemies, strategies, power-ups, everything. And then when it came to America, they just reworked it into the horizontal landscape format.
I don't think most Western people understand, maybe even people in Japan don't understand, that the disk system, that was the future to them. Like,
yeah,
they were like, this is what we do now.
It was a hard break. Yeah. And I didn't bring the Japanese Zelda manual, but I did bring the Legend of Zelda 1 manual, which was when they released the system on NES. And, you know, it's the standard NES manual format and basically has all the content from the Japanese manual and American manual from 1986-87. This was 1992, I think.
And it just carries that forward into
a new format. So, you know, basically, after Nintendo kind of did that jumping off to the disk system, they were like, let's bring that back into the Famicom. And when they started making Famicom games again at the end of 1988, and so, you know, moved away from the disk system, like, that just became kind of the standard for the content they were creating.
I remember the Kid Icarus manual was extremely similar to the Metroid manual. Mm-hmm. And I also remember that my brothers and I were laughing because
the siren titty. Yeah.
She had her titties out. We were like,
I knew where you were going with that, Nadia.
Of course you did. That's why I'm on the show. But it was pretty funny.
But yeah, The Legend of Zelda came out around the same time as Metroid. Not only did it include a full-color manual with tons of lore and enemies and little mini-maps, it also came with an actual fold-out map.
Oh.
And I'm going to drop and destroy.
It's currently on the floor.
Yes.
He just picked it up.
But the this is not technically the manual, but it's part of the manual in a sense. Oh, someone wrote on this one. That's great.
Oh, no.
It's great. They marked bushes you can burn. There's
Oh, beautiful.
Like whoever owned this and I bought this from, or whoever, you know, the person who sold it to me bought it from, had kind of their own cartography system where it looks like there are arrows very specific to tiles and bushes, like bomb here, burn here.
Mm.
They've marked where the levels are in the blank portions of the corners of the map.
I love that kind of stuff. That's the stuff that when you had to rent games, that's the stuff that saved you, because people before you would write in the instruction books, let's say, to write passwords, they'd write tips, so that if you had a game for like a couple of days, it could really help you out.
Yeah, there was sort of a weird communication system that
there
we
was.
Had
it was very, very much a community. It was kind of disembodied.
But even the map here is an instruction manual, not on how to play the game, but how to experience the game. It has an entire page dedicated to how to create a map of a video game.
Oh,
so it gives you two maps for the first two dungeons. And then it says, here is a grid like that shows you the first few rooms of the next three or four dungeons. And then, you know, how big that grid is, you finish it yourself.
Like, so this is how you create a map. America, this part?
Yeah, this is the American manual.
Yeah.
That's what you would use your old math books for when you were a kid, your old math notebooks that had grid paper.
Yeah, pretty much. Anyway. Yeah, on the inside.
Yeah, yeah.
So, you know, clue books always come with the maps for every dungeon, but for games like Bard's Tale or My Magic, everything was on like a 16 by 16 or a 32 by 32 grid. And so as, you know, an avid DD player at the time, I would always just use my map paper, my graph paper, to sit there and map the game as I was playing it.
Man, I miss Etrian Odyssey.
They said they're going to announce something about it soon, so who knows?
I bet Fantasy Star didn't tell you how to make maps. And
it probably should have. It really should have.
Well, now there's a version that just has the maps built in.
Oh,
thank
so
God.
Thank God. Yeah, it's a great version.
I need to play the translated version you worked on at some point. I think we don't have
maps, though. So.
No, I mean, there's only so much you can do on the original hardware. But,
but that, the latest version does have the like experience doubling stuff.
Nice.
So, yeah, it's really good.
Cool.
Yeah, when I get to that on Sega Gaiden videos, I will definitely capture your version of the game and be like, hey, I'm not dealing with 1987 bullshit. I'm playing a better version.
I'm proud of it.
Anyway, so Metroid was, this was a very big sidebar about my experience. It's all about me, really, centering myself.
Well, it's your show, man.
Well, your experience is what's spread out on the bed right now, so.
Ooh.
Sort of, yeah, that sounds amazing.
spicy.
It's a very sexy podcast.
What did I get myself into?
Sorry, Jason, you've got to be the one who calms us. Anyway, Metroid, you know, that game came with a very shiny silver box. It sounded very interesting to me. I heard my friends talking about it at school. It was the first game I bought for my NES with my own money. And, you know, I went on a shopping trip to Target with my aunt, who was like, yeah, just you can come along with me to Target. I was like, oh, great. I've got some money. I want to buy a video game. I saw Metroid. I was like, this is the one I want. She was like, oh, that's not very expensive. I'll buy it for you. I was like, no, I have to buy this game myself. Now I look back in the past, I'm like, you dumbass, you could have had two games.
Wow.
Yeah,
but, idiot.
But because, you know, I saved up for a few months to be able to buy this game, I bought it with my own money, I was proud of that. I just remember the ride home from the store, I was just vibrating with excitement to play this game. I could not wait, but I couldn't play yet because I was in a car and we didn't have, you know, portable emulation systems or anything like that. So I contented myself with just poring over the manual and just absorbing everything in there.
Yeah.
And then, you know, as Metroid stumped me for weeks, months, and I was like, where do I go in this game? It's so confusing. I would always go back to the manual. I would look at the layout of the world in there and be like, there's all this stuff that I can't find. I know it's here. How do I get to it? And that was a huge incentive for me. And, you know, the game, you know, we go back and play Metroid on Nintendo Switch Online or on Virtual Console or whatever, on emulators, and it's fine. It's, you know, it's kind of old and has a lot of weird flaws, but that doesn't really get to the full Metroid experience that I had, because to me, Metroid was, yes, it was about playing the game, but it was also about constantly referring back to the manual and seeing all these enemies, seeing all these things that I hadn't gotten yet, that I hadn't found yet, and wondering, how is that out there? How can I use the things that I have gotten to get there?
Well, that's also just, you know, no one plays games like that anymore. And I don't mean the manual part, just the playing a game for 2 months way, you know, where
we tend to move on very quickly.
Unless it's a persistent game.
Right.
Sure.
Yeah. Something like Genshin Impact or something where it's designed to be played forever.
Yeah.
Yeah, one ritual I kind of miss is the whole reading the instruction booklet on the way home thing, where you'd, whenever I entered a game, I'd always read the instruction booklet on the way home. Or when we had one TV in the house, and when my father was watching hockey or baseball or whatever, I'd have to spend that time to just kind of study the manual.
So when I was giving my kids my old DS games, they would read the manuals in the car. And I was thinking about how I used to read manuals in cars, when we'd buy something and bring it home, and just how touching this was. And this stopped about, you know, 3 or 4 years ago when they moved on from my DS games to 3DS games and then Switch games.
Tradition.
And now there's no manuals.
No.
Not rarely.
Very few manuals to speak of.
Yeah, yeah.
And they're generally just like, here is a safety tip sheet.
Yeah, but it's funny because you're talking about these manuals and these memories, and then I printed out Curse of the Azure Bonds, which was one of the early Gold Box D&D games. Mm-hmm. And so you get this manual, great manual, that you can practically use in some ways as a first edition, you know, player's handbook if you needed to. And it would have some really nice, had little illustrations and how to play and introductions, but then it goes over your ability scores and, you know, what the classes are and what they do, because this is, you know, it wasn't assuming you knew D&D, but it helped.
My first experience with like a really big beefy manual for a PC game was I got Star Control 2 at a thrift shop, and eventually ended up playing Urquan Masters instead, but I just kind of really loved the instruction booklet. It wasn't even an instruction booklet. It was a literal book with like the hard binding that came with the game. And it told you everything about why you were there, what was going on, what the races were, what their problems were, made you terrified of the Androsynth. It was a really, really, really nicely put together manual that I still have somewhere because it's just fantastic. Every other game, we kind of pirated those. So we really came up against copyright protection, and sometimes we died. Like, I used to love Master of Orion, and that game used to test you by stopping in the middle of everything and saying, okay, go to your manual, look at page so-and-so, and name the ship on the corner of this page. And if you couldn't do that properly, they would kill you instantly. So
you know, that's funny, because I'm just about to get to that. The appendices here are from Curse of Azure Bonds, or, you know, things you would see in a player's handbook for D&D. You know, even down to the tables for experience. Mm-hmm. And I can remember there was a couple sessions played first edition where we'd go back and say, oh, we forgot our handbooks. Let's pull out one of these video game manuals. And then you had the translation wheels. This was the copy protection. And you would get to a part, it would say, check this and, you know, make these symbols and then type in what comes in here. Sometimes these things would be associated with the story too. Or you get, like, for the TIE Fighter manual, you would have these characters in Aramash, which is the Star Wars script. And it would say, you know, oh yeah, to check, you know, insert these characters. And here they'd be along the bottom of the manuals here. And you would have to see, it's this. And then you'd say, oh, it would show you these three characters in Aramash. And then you'd have to write out type it in what it was. And copy protection, because you might remember the old don't copy that floppy and those kind of things. And because, yes, my friends and I, we copied games.
Everyone.
You know, until the CD era. And everyone did. But we didn't have access to things like copy machines. We could copy games, but we didn't have a copy machine. You know, we're still getting dittos at school on ditto machines. So we would all have this notebook that we would pass along to each other with all the copy protection checks for the manuals inside them.
That's really cool. Yeah, because my brother had to print out the copy protection manual stuff for Master of Orion. But that was back in the day when you could do that, when you could go online and find those things, just barely, but it could be done.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and that sort of mindset eventually made its way to consoles as rentals increased and people started blasting through games. There were a few different approaches developers could take to, you know, combat the fact that people were renting games instead of buying them. Some of them were to make the game unreasonably hard, like Ninja Gaiden 3, where it's basically, unlike the Japanese version, impossible to beat the game without cheating or just a lot of self-abuse. But
Castlevania 3 was the same way.
Oh, Castlevania 3 wasn't nearly as bad as Ninja Gaiden 3 because at least it had infinite continues.
That's true. But
it, and like, it also had Help Me.
It did have Help Me. But if you died at Dracula and they were going to do all the way back to the beginning of the level instead of by the staircase, that was so infuriating.
That was pretty brutal.
I didn't realize there was an analog to this with...
Well, and then you have something like Star Tropics, which I brought the manual to. Star Tropics, you know, standard Nintendo manual, NES manual. It's got, you know, some story, some mechanics, how to play, blah, blah, blah. Here's the weapons you can get. But bound to the back of the manual, there's a little letter from your Uncle Steve. And Uncle Steve says, "Dear Mike, I am sorry I did not write you sooner, but I just returned from a long voyage in the islands in search of lost ruins and artifacts. Blah, 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 blah." Anyway, it's a nice little letter. Very cute. It's a feely, basically, you know, Infocom style. What does it mean? You don't know. But it says at the very bottom, "Do not eat, taste, or otherwise consume this paper." That seems like an important note. "This letter is very important, so please hold on to it until the end of the game." And at some point in the game, you're told, find the letter from your Uncle Steve, and I believe you dip it in water?
Water, yeah.
Yeah.
And once you dip it in water, which clearly the previous owner of this had done, there is, you know, invisible ink that will be revealed, and it reveals a radio frequency, which I believe is 747.
Oh, look at me.
And the instruction, yeah, basically the letter that came with the instructions is the ability, like your ability to get past that point of the game. If you were getting a photocopied manual from the rental shop, you wouldn't get that. If you were getting the copyright safe rewritten manuals that they started including, what were those called? Do you remember? There was a brand name for them.
Oh, I don't remember the names, but you're talking about like in the hard clamshell, there would be printed instructions. I can't remember.
I mean, at some point, Nintendo started cracking down on rental shops by using copyright law and said, "Hey, you're distributing photocopies of our manuals. That's copyrighted material. You can't do this."
Right. Mm-hmm. I mean, they didn't want people renting games at all. Right. And they couldn't stop that. So they just tried to find an angle.
A loophole.
They used whatever levers they could. And that was one of them.
I never heard of invisible ink in a manual for copy.
Well, it didn't happen a lot, but it happened with Star Tropics.
It is really cool.
And it's a fun little detail. There were, you know, other instances like that. Metal Gear Solid. At some point, you have to get a radio frequency, and they tell you to look at the back of the game case, which takes you out of the game, and you actually have to go and look at the back of the PlayStation case, and there's a screenshot that has, you know, a radio frequency codec call, and you look at the radio frequency in that screenshot, and that's the radio frequency you call in-game.
I mean, so, it's like the... Because it's a screenshot of later in the game. Yeah. So it's like... It's the equivalent of a comic character like looking down below the gutter at what's about to happen in the future and like commenting on it.
It's, pretty much, yeah. Yeah, so occasionally you did come across console games that would use these mechanics, these tricks to kind of work around the danger of borrowing or renting games, and would use the manual as kind of a means to basically force someone to buy the game, or, you know, at least have access to the manual in order to advance. So that copy protection scheme type stuff, it never got quite as creative, I think, as on PC, where you had stuff the Mix and Mojo wheel for Monkey Island 2, where you basically had, you know, a code wheel, basically, but it was full of illustrations. You know, things like that got very, very creative. And
you had the manuals where you had to have the red film to like reveal what it actually said. And if you tried to photocopy it, you wouldn't have the blue and red to differentiate.
Yeah, I actually appreciate how many of them really tried to implement themselves into the game's world. Like, they wouldn't just put some random letters on an instruction booklet page and say, "Okay, just give us these letters." It was almost always something connected to the world that you were in. Like, Star Control 2, their copyright protection was a big ass map. And it was like, "Okay, identify the planet at this location," which was always really difficult because it'd give you some small ass planet that you couldn't see, but at least you were still kind of within the game, as it were.
Yeah, and Zach McCracken had a newspaper that was like the newspaper you wrote for in the game that was giving you more of the lore, but then I think the copy protection was like your flight itinerary or something. And like when you were flying, you had to put in like the code that was on your itinerary in the game, which I thought was cool.
So the thing I miss about old manuals are stuff like this, and this is a message from Sid Meier.
That is Sid Meier. Look at baby Sid Meier.
For Silent Service.
Maybe he was kind of middle-aged looking.
and they'd be telling you, okay, this is what we made and why we made it, and a little message from the author like you might get in a book. Mm-hmm. And a lot of PC games had things like this because... And if I remember right, some Electronic Artists console games did, too. I know their PC
They probably did. Like, they had their names on, like, Will Harvey's Indie Golf. Stuff like that. Yeah.
And you're able to make these personal connections. Now, nowadays, you get these as, some sort of blog on a website or
Kickstarter
video.
Update. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. But I really appreciate these. And this was before, Sid had done Civ. And at that time, he was known for Strike Eagle. Flight sim game, and I really missed these kind of little notes because they always made a little more personal connection. And I don't know about you, but with today's games, the connection I can make a connection to the game, but I don't feel like I'm making any connection to the people who make it. Mm-hmm.
It depends, yeah, but I know what you mean. It at the very least, it kind of made the game look like a much more serious art form when you have the quote unquote author of the game addressing the player. Hello, I am so and so. I made this game for you.
I have a couple of random things that come to mind just on the subject of manuals. The Broderbund's inclusion of things like World Almanacs for the Carmen Sandiego game.
Oh, of course.
I remember those.
Where, I mean, the stories vary, and I'm sure Kate Willard will set the record straight at some point, but the story that I had heard was essentially that the Carlsons had made a deal with World Book or whatever to, package books, to get a good price basically on bulk books, and they're like, design a game that uses one of these books, and that's kind of where Carmen Sandiego came from, the idea of okay, it's a world almanac, and it's maybe not an instruction manual, but it is like the clue book that's necessary to play the game is an actual world almanac that comes with the game, and that's kind of a unique manual like situation. Mm-hmm.
Those almanacs were cool. They were useful.
Yeah, that's how we traveled the world before the internet.
Even the NES version came with one of those.
Package. Yeah. I don't think it was a unique book either. I think it was just a size that happened to fit in an NES book. Another random memory for me is as a kid, 13-ish, I went to a thrift store and there was just this shoebox full of game manuals for the Atari 400.
Wow.
Just random games. It was just packed with them. And I was like, can I buy this? And I don't know. Yeah, $2, kid. And I had myself a good time imagining these bizarre games I was reading the manuals for. I mean, I kind of remember one that was like a parody of New York City. I think it's just called New York City or something. And it's just, cabbies trying to kill you and the next level is you're in a bank and everyone's trying to shoot you, but you got to make your withdrawal while avoiding getting shot and stuff like that. I'm like, that
sounds like New York.
This isn't on Nintendo. And the other thing I was saving, we already talked about. So that ends my list. No, wait, there was one other memory comes to mind for me, which is Tiny Toon Adventures on the Game Boy I had as a kid. And in that manual, like in some of the manuals we talked about, there's sort of a layout of all the enemies in the game, including all the bosses, and they all had drawings. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember exactly what the enemy was, but it was like there's this final boss, and you don't encounter him playing through the game. When you play through the game, you just kind of jump on Montana Max's head until he dies or whatever. It's just horrible death. There's just like he's like twitching on the ground, and his mother cries. That's not true. But in the manual, something like the final boss after him is like Max in a mech or something. Like it was something ridiculous. It is not in the game, but when you play the game, when you encounter Max, and he's, I don't remember the plot, he probably kidnapped Babs. That's what you do in games.
Yeah, that was the first one.
He's like, all right, I'll release her if you pay me this ridiculous amount of diamonds, which was the collectibles in the game, which you will not have at that point in the game because you spent them. But I was like, oh, maybe if you actually save up mm-hmm. that many diamonds, then he'll be like, aha, now you have to fight my final form. But so I went through the entire game slowly, just collected literally every diamond in the game and had enough, but he was just like, I'm gonna fight you anyway. I guess they just cut that. They cut that enemy or something. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah. I brought in the Bionic Commando NES manual.
Okay.
Because you did sometimes get that where the manuals were created
before the game
was finalized.
Yeah.
You
know, the production process was different. This one isn't so dramatic, but it uses a lot of terminology that doesn't show up in the final game. In the game, you're fighting.
Yes, bite Hitler.
You're fighting an army called the Bads.
Okay.
It's very B-A-D-D.
Okay.
So you know they're not good. They're Bads. but, you know, there's this kind of Nazi-ish thing to them. Kind of makes you wonder, especially when the final boss is Hitler.
with a monocle.
But in the manual, it has the transcription of the text you see on the introductory kind of scroll.
Oh, is it different?
And it says, you know, it's just like in the game. I'll talk about a person which I met when I was young. Great grammar.
Yeah.
In 1980X, we found Naz's top secret material called Naz's. Albatross.
Ooh.
N-A-Z-Z.
Wow.
So they went from Nazi to Naz.
Wow.
When this manual was created. And I think at that point, Nintendo was still like, you know, I think they still might know what you're talking about. So that they kept the consonant, vowel, double consonant thing, but they changed it from Naz to Bad.
Right.
And so you kind of in between the Japanese game and the American final release. And there were a few other little quirks in this manual that I can't remember off the top of my head.
I know Mega Man Legends 2 had the same thing going on with this instruction booklet, where certain characters were translated very differently from the game. So yeah, same situation.
Yeah, you'd think the cartridge ROM would take longer to produce than a paper manual because they had to be made in Japan. But I guess, you know, this was sent off to the press before that was all finalized. It's a weird manual because they also, I think they were just trying to fill out space because they give you three consecutive pages that show the area map layout. It doesn't have any purpose beyond the first page is like, here's the stage map.
Yeah.
And the second map is like, how to play. Well, we've only got two sentences here. Let's stick the stage map in there again. Next page. Well,
another
two more sentences. I guess we'll use the stage map again.
Could that be another sign that this was done early and maybe they didn't have enough art that could fit that space?
I don't know.
Just never went back and fixed it.
Yeah, I think this was just like, you know, get it out the door. There wasn't a whole lot of quality control outside of Nintendo and a handful of other publishers. You know, you had Konami manuals where...
Oh, yes. Legend.
You know, we can question the quality of those very liberal translations and fighting Vernon Katafi in... or Hyrule Cockamamie.
What?
Those are the Metal Gear manuals.
Really?
Someone had so much
like
fun.
These backstories that have nothing to do with the games. You have to... Colonel South... Colonel South.
Okay.
Has leading you on a mission to fight Hyrule Cockamamie.
Wow.
Yeah. And it's, you know, like this punchy, funny script. But then for a game like Metal Gear, where there's a lot of in-game dialogue and an actual story.
It's like, it's right there, dude. You could
have just talked about Big Boss and Solid Snake.
I remember one manual that confused the heck out of me, and correct me if I'm wrong, but it didn't seem like it really applied to the game, and that was Section Z's on the NES.
Not familiar with it.
I don't remember much of it because it wasn't very helpful. The parts are like how to control your character was, but you know the game had this whole area where you go left or right and change.
So it didn't explain the main mechanic of trying to find Section Z.
I hate that.
I actually just remembered reading the video game update Computer Entertainer newsletter when they reviewed Section Z, like they reamed it. Because they said the manual didn't make any sense.
Yeah, I remember
so
the manual just not making any sense.
There must have been like some weird misprint. Maybe they were like writing up the arcade game, which plays very differently than the NES.
Yeah, it plays very differently. I remember my brother and I, we would knock our heads against the wall trying to figure out how to play this game because the enemies were cool, you know, guy in a jetpack flying in a space is cool, shooting things were cool, but we couldn't make hide or tail of it.
Okay, quick theory that comes to mind for me is that Capcom USA from the same place was doing the like Commodore and NES versions at the same time. So maybe it's based on a Commodore version that's kind of weird.
That could be. That would be very interesting. It would explain a few things.
Yeah.
Well, speaking of just like a story to fill in, this is something else I wrote for US Gamer, and that was the manual for Mega Man X3, which is an absolutely beautiful snapshot in time of Web 1.0. And they basically made this instruction manual to look like a web page.
So this would be like 1994, 1995?
It was 1995. Basically, it was made to look like 1995 internet. And if you look on US Gamer, look for the article, it's still there. But they use like embossing like from like Paint Shop Pro, and they use like links, and it's all set up like a 1995 web page. So there's no hub. It's all just a scattered like welcome to my site sort of setup for an organization that's supposed to be like most powerful in the world. I absolutely adore it. Like if you can find it, you will not find an instruction book like it anywhere. It's art at this point.
Find a scan, because that book's probably like $500 these days.
Yeah, there are scans online. I used one for my article. So they are certainly there. I bless the people who scan instruction booklets and preserve them, because that was amazing.
Yeah, I'm looking over the Section Z instructions, and like it does seem specific to the NES game, but it does a terrible job of explaining stuff.
That's like, strange.
So Section Z, you know, at the end of each stage, they're auto-scrolling stages. Mm-hmm. At the end of each stage, there are two warp beams. And you get into one, and it'll take you to a different level. And depending on which beam you go into, it warps you to a separate level, a distinct level from the other. Sometimes you'll find red transmitters, like the beams. And if you fly into those, they'll kill you until you've defeated or like broken some sort of barrier or something. And then they'll turn into an active barrier or active warp that you can go into. So this is telling you, like, strong red barriers surround two transmitters found at stage one. To clear these red barriers, you must destroy the enemy generators supplying power to the barriers. Like, it's not actually telling you what you do in stage one. It's telling you, it's a very, like, weird, cryptic way of explaining a game mechanic in a way that does not actually explain it at all.
I think Capcom got 20 additional, maybe 30 additional hours on my brother and I played it just trying to figure it out.
Yeah, but they couldn't upcharge you back then.
No.
I just kept you from going and buying another Capcom game, such as Trojan or Commando.
Yeah.
So in the end, they lost.
Trojan's awesome.
I don't remember the manual for that one, though.
I think I read it, and it was very much a Capcom Konami manual for that era.
It's me, Capcom President Joe Morici here.
Oh, what was with that? I felt like, are you trying to like be my friend? That was really strange. Every Capcom manual had that opening. Like, hi, this is a, what was his name?
Joe Morici.
Yeah.
I think. Please correct me if I'm wrong. Jeremy. Yeah.
I did like certain Capcom manuals, though. I think one of the ones that really made an impression on me was Mega Man 3, because that had some really nice illustrations in it. And a really baffling picture of Mega Man hanging out with the Mega Man 2 bosses that I did not understand because I had never played 2 at that point. And I'm like, aren't these the robots I fought in those horrible broken worlds? Why am I friends with them? This is confusing.
Yeah, one of my favorite things about old manuals is when people write stuff that's just like helpful. I have a Top Gun manual where, you know, it's a Konami manual for NES. So it's just white with the logo on it. Mm-hmm. So it's just a big blank white thing. And someone very, very helpfully wrote in blue pen, they have an up arrow that says down and a down arrow that says up. They're explaining the controls to themselves for the flight yoke orientation.
That's cute.
So that's even though that's explained in the manual, they wrote it on the cover so they could just have it right there with them. Here's another great one.
It's a very Homer Simpson thing.
It's like writing your name on your hand or something.
But this black belt manual for Sega Master System, which of course was a Fist in the North Star game that got the license removed. The previous owner of this very helpfully wrote next to the character illustrations, next to the hero's illustration, it says you. He wrote you to let you know which of these characters you are. And then the enemies are all presented in order, and he helpfully wrote 1, 2, 3.
They're out of order. Yeah. Manual. So this is
so
helpful.
He wrote that the actual correction for the order in which you face them. And of course, you know, there's no mention of Fist of the North Star in here. It says, what's happening? Kyoko, your beautiful Japanese girlfriend, has gotten herself into a beautiful Japanese mess.
Oh no.
Yeah.
Oh no.
All right.
My goodness gracious me.
They at Tonka here? Is this Tonka?
I think this was just under Sega. Yeah.
Al Nilsson, come on.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've been going through and buying a bunch of old games over the last, 10 years or so?
Yep.
What's the weirdest thing you found people write in a manual?
I don't know. I haven't found anything really. I feel like I have found some weird stuff, and I've probably tweeted about it, but nothing that sticks in my memory because I'm old and forget stuff like that all the time. You understand. I think stuff like you or down up, like just that kind of thing.
I think down up has got to be the best.
That's great.
I don't know how you get that.
Because it's just
great.
Like, I just know that kid was getting so frustrated because he didn't understand why am I pressing up and going down? This is so stupid. It makes no sense. So he wrote that on his manual, or she wrote that on her manual. They wrote it on their manual just to remind them at all times.
Yeah.
No, you fool. The directions don't do what you think.
This is not necessarily a manual, but it's writing stuff. I got a copy of Railroad Tycoon, the original, at a thrift store for nothing. That, like, I picked it up because it was just bulging. Like, it was just, like, overflowing. And inside, you know, is the discs and the actual manual and stuff. But there's an actual notebook from the previous owner. Like, basically, it's like his log of like his railroad. It's like, and there's like printouts from the internet from like the early 90s of like strategies for being good at Railroad Tycoon. And
I find it very sad you found that in a thrift store. It feels like maybe it was someone's like something they love very much, and some mother just packed it up and sent it off.
Or they died, so it could.
That's not much better, but yes, yeah, it could be death. It's all right.
Oh, I think I recognize this one in your hand. It's from like a big box disc system game, right?
Kieta Princess from the creators of Battle of Olympus.
Okay.
And by creators, I mean the same two people who made Battle of Olympus made this game. I wanted to bring this one in just because it gets to, you know, once the console gaming boom really hit in the Nintendo era, packaging for games became so much more elaborate to the point where the question becomes, like, what even is a manual anymore? Yeah. Like, this one, Kieta Princess, is one of three games from... What was the publisher?
Wavejack.
Wavejack was the line. I don't think it was the brand. I think it was Imagineering.
Okay.
Or, yeah, it was Imagineering, the same company that printed or published Battle of Olympus.
I mean, the manual looks like a Japanese guidebook.
So...
That you'd buy separately.
This game... I think all of these games were tie-ins with vocal idols.
Like, okay.
You know... The flavor of the moment singers. There were three of them. Each of them came with a tape cassette. One of them was like a Galaxy Heroes thing that has like a radio drama on it. But this one has pop songs by Yasuko-chan. So some, you know, flavor of the moment J-pop idol was kind of highlighted in this game. And so this entire thing is like in the studio with Yasuko-chan.
Wow.
And it's got like manga in it, and I don't even know what all this stuff is, but basically I think the idea of the game is that the idol who sings in the game is kidnapped and you have to go save her, and it's not a very good game. I played it and it's pretty miserable, but there's just so much to this manual that's just like, you know, manga style illustrations about...
And it came with the game.
What's that? Yeah, this came with the game. The box is like... You know, the disc system disc is 3 inches, but this came in a box. It's about like 6 inches tall, about 2 inches, 3 inches thick. It's really big. It came with a cassette tape. It came with a sticker to put on the side of the box because they didn't come with individual labels on the side. It came with this, which is like just a book to put notes in.
Wow.
As you play.
Oh, it's like a daily log.
I guess it's like a detective adventure game, and you're supposed to keep track of stuff. It came with this big fold-out map, which also is, yes, that's right, a poster of Yasuko-chan.
There she is.
Yasuko Tometa.
Mm-hmm.
So, I don't know. It's like half game manual, half strategy guide, half storybook. There's a lot of halves in here. Parts of it are black and white. Parts of it are color. It explains how to play the game. It explains the making of the game. Wow. Anyway... Yeah, so you really saw them kind of go to great elaborate measures in some of these.
Like, I'm really tricked into wanting to play this game right now.
It's really it's not amazing.
Look at it. I think I've seen this.
It's kind of a mess, but they put so much care into the packaging.
Oh, yeah, this one.
And I only bought it because, one, of the Battle of Olympus connection, but two, I'm trying to own all the Famicom games that came with tape cassettes, which I think is just that and Athena. There might be more. I don't know.
I didn't know that any came with tape cassettes.
It's so funny, though, because this looks like something that a boutique publisher nowadays would make.
Mm-hmm. Oh, exactly. Yeah. Yeah. Like, that's a thing, working with limited run games. Like, this is the kind of stuff that we do. Like, for Chasm, I did the production on the release of that one and put together a 64-page book, almost exactly the same size, with, a big interview with the developer where he was talking about, like, here's what went right, here's what went wrong, mm-hmm. Some essays, an essay, like, a feature on how the map system, the random generation works, lots of artwork and things like that. So, yeah, like, you still see stuff like this, and, you know, whenever I have the bandwidth and opportunity to do something like this, I'm like, I want to do this. I'm working on Axiom Verge 2 now, and I want to put cool stuff into that package, too.
I love writing that kind of stuff.
Yeah, it's great. And, you know, I love these old game releases that are like this because, you know, it's part of this sort of legacy. Like, this is something I never saw as a kid, but when I discovered it as an adult, I was like, this is my jam. I don't like this game, but wow, it's so cool that this exists. Like, this is basically a mini magazine. Yeah.
I understand that passion. I do.
Absolutely. So, video game manuals.
Yeah, I don't know that I will ever engage with a game on that level again, where it's like, mm-hmm. sit down and like read the lore and stuff like that. I don't care about the lore.
The lore is the fun part. But I'm speaking as a Final Fantasy XIV stan.
Sure, so. Sure.
Yeah.
But I mean, even like 15, it's like, I guess I watched that movie or whatever, but it's like, I didn't like go think about it after.
Yeah, you know? I think that's not a great example.
You should think about how Noctis is a very pretty boy.
Now, they're only in PDF form these days, but every now and then I will still go through a really deep dive of a manual for a very technical, you know, World War One or Two simulation type game, like for Jutland. That one, it has no tutorial, so you have to dive into the manual to learn how to navigate the ships and that. Oh, yeah, you really have to calculate the trajectory of your cannon shells and stuff like that. But otherwise, you know, it's sad. I mean, if you're going to look for a manual, no, you're more looking for a build or a loadout or something that someone else has made.
I don't agree that it's sad. All that stuff's in the game now. Like, I much prefer the game tell me how to play it than, like, have to look somewhere else.
So. Well, I would like it to be kind of both.
I like to kill trees, Frank. I like to kill trees.
To me, the both experience is, like, reading critique on the game now or, like, watching a YouTube video. Like to me, the experience of the manual is, like, stepping away from the game but still engaging with it. And I think we have a lot more ways to do that now. And, you know, I totally get the nostalgia for the manuals. Like, I'm never going to relive the moment of reading the manual in the car because I can't play the game again. Everyone of our generations had that. But things are so much better now. I don't know. Sorry, is that not the way I'm supposed to talk on Retronauts?
No, it's fine.
You're fired.
To celebrate how things have improved. I am grateful that games now have the means to make sense within the game, as opposed to being these cryptic things where you have to sit down with a big binder of information. But I do like, you know, obviously with the work that I do, my day job, I do like having that kind of physical token. And I, you know, for me, I see more value, and this is kind of how I approach things, in talking about the creative process behind the games and in getting insights into the creators' minds. Like the stuff that I work on, I've worked on some manuals, but what I really want to do is like lay out parts of the game and, you know, explore and explain in ways that you're not going to get just from playing the game, just from reading, you know, the in-game guidance or whatever, to like add insight, to add depth and substance to it. Mm-hmm. Like to me, you know, it's almost like you could publish a book about this game later, or you could include it in the game. And people who really get into it will have that substance there for them to say, like, oh, this is great. This is more of, you know, lets me just immerse myself even that much more into this game that I'm enjoying.
Well, and what you're doing, you have the audience for that already. They're buying the game because they want to, like, buy this physical thing and own it. And they you know, they're, yes,
some of them
in most cases, paying more money than they would, you know, just downloading it, I'm sure. So, you know, there's definitely an audience for that stuff, and I'm glad it's being served.
But, you know, a lot of the function of manuals isn't just in games, but it's also been taken up by wikis and discords and game facts and so on and so forth. There's so many free information resources out there that, you know, that's why manuals pretty much went away in the past decade. We got to PlayStation 3 and then PlayStation 4 to Vita to Switch, and you just stop seeing manuals in games. It was basically like, here's a slip that tells you how not to, like, destroy your eyeballs if you play a game, or, like, set your house on fire.
If you have seizures, please stop.
Yeah,
that's pretty much it. That and the combination of good in-game tutorials of, you know, how to teach you the mechanics.
Right, but to me, that just opens up the opportunity to include something different in the game. And not every game lends itself to that. And some games are so immense that you couldn't possibly begin to cover the scope of the game within some sort of insert in the package.
Yeah.
But, you know, having, to me, like, I'm just someone who loves to read and loves to have, you know, a book or something that I can immerse myself in when I enjoy a work. Like, I want to read, you know, I watch a show that I find interesting, or read a comic or something, or read a book. And I'm like, well, this was great, but I want to get behind it. I want to learn more about its legacy and how people reacted to it and, you know, what the creative process was. So, yeah, to me, that's more interesting now than manuals.
Yeah.
But there was a lot of that kind of, you know, sometimes in games like this, like Sid Meier saying, hey, welcome to my simulation. Or here saying, hey, here's this singer that is up and coming in the pop world. Let's talk about, you know, her day-to-day routine and what she does in the studio.
Well, and I mentioned that looks like a guidebook from the time, and that's something that's, you know, worth at least mentioning too, is that in Japan at the time you could get like a second manual essentially in the in the guidebook. So like if you get the guidebook for Mother, for example, which comes to mind as one of the few that I own, it's like it's just more manual in addition to being the moment-to-moment guide. It's like a better map. You know, it's like some interviews in the back. It's just, there's more art, right? So it's like there was sort of a way of getting more of that sort of thing in Japan if you wanted it, as opposed to here where the guidebooks were pretty much just straight guidebooks when they finally got around to existing.
You got some of that in the Nintendo Player's Guides. They started doing the separate Nintendo Power Player's Guides, like Legend of Zelda Link to the Past, Super Metroid, they would start to include lore.
That's
like
true.
Weird stuff like, hey, let's tell you all about the clothes that Link wears.
Right.
I remember reading that in Link to the Past Guide. I was like, do I need to know the history of the Hylian tunic? Right. Like
that was also the guide where they tell you why Link holds his shield in his left arm when he's facing Death Mountain, because it's a superstition, which is a good way of explaining away a sprite.
Sprite mirroring, yeah.
That's really good.
Yeah, it was really good.
Anyway, yeah, no, Frank, I don't think you're wrong that manuals are pretty much obsolete, but there is some comfort in, you know, opening a game that you pay money for and saying, oh, there's something in here. It's not just a plastic case and a little 1-inch tall Switch card.
So the most recent game that I've spent extra for the upscale package on was when Limited Run just did X-Wing and TIE Fighter.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And I got the big box with that had all the goodies in it.
Yeah, I didn't work on that one. What was involved in that with the goodies? Was there anything like printed matter, or was it just like...
Yeah, okay. Some of the old manuals and they had cards, like trading cards, which I'd never seen with a Limited Run thing before.
Yeah, I mean, Frank and I both worked on the Monkey Island anthology collection book.
I want to see that book.
It's off to press. It took a long time to go through all the approvals process because it's a very long book. It's like 240 pages long, but it's like an oral history with 14 or 15 developers. But I also scanned all the manuals for all the games up to Tales of Monkey Island because I don't think it had a manual. Mm-hmm. But it's interesting because it goes from like 4 pages to 8 pages to, by the time you get to Escape from Monkey Island, it's like 64 full color pages. At that point, I just had to like print them like too small to actually read.
Yeah.
But just wanted to get the complete packaging in there to say, hey, here's what all shipped for that game. But it was interesting to see what was included in that. But that was, you know, that was a challenging project, but also a lot of fun to put together. Kurt Collada did a bunch of interviews with devs and just arranging 60,000 words of text and paring it down and organizing it. And I haven't really played all the way through any of the Monkey Island games, but I know so much about them now.
So when you do these big collections, you're getting all the official material, but do you ever go for third-party guidebooks that came out at the time and try to include anything from that?
That's certainly something we've looked into. I don't know if anything will ever come of that, but yeah, absolutely. Like people love strategy guides.
Yes.
You know, they were a good business, and you know, they won't subsist at the level that they were at one point. But you know, as a boutique item, I think there is some merit to that. And some of those things sell for a lot of money. So reprinting them, like I have a few strategy guides that are like $100. It's wild, but it's people want that. So
it's the Final Fantasy IX instruction booklet, right?
Yes, died. That's worth 100 curses, I think.
Yeah,
Well, just the big fancy Dark Souls book that Prima made. That's like this thick, and it's like a full book, and it's these full glossy pages. Was $100 last time I looked at half price books when I just dropped in.
Yeah,
it was like, with all their big fancy books, not just with their game cards.
Well, with a bunch of Pokemon games, get not only like the basic strategy guide, but then you also get the Pokedex guide for each volume.
Yes.
So it's there's money to be made out there selling people information about video games still, but most of that no longer comes in the games themselves. So that's the kind of the nature of things these days. Like you get a thing, but if you want other things, that's going to cost you extra.
Yeah, pretty much.
And that pays my bills, so I guess I can't complain.
So keep doing it.
Keep buying extra stuff. Anyway, here's JJ and Jeff.
The podcast just ends right there.
That's right.
That's the sign out right there.
But yeah, I think we've actually covered this topic in pretty exhaustive detail, as much as we can, with the kind of loose mission statement. I don't think I really have too much more to say about manuals. There were a few letters, but I think I'm going to reserve those, as so often happens with letters these days, for a mailbag episode.
All right.
So we will revisit those another time. And I think with this, we will call it a day. It's actually been a full-length episode, so...
We did it
for us. Thanks, Jeff Vlasic, for recommending this topic or requesting this topic.
This was fun to talk about.
It was a good conversation.
Yeah,
I enjoyed it.
Is this plug time?
It is. Why don't we start with Nadia, since you are remote, and I hope we didn't trample over the things you had to say by mistake just because of the...
Oh, no, no. Okay. No, I'm an expert at this now. basically... I am, again, Nadia Oxford. I am the co-host of the Acts of the Blood God podcast, where we talk about RPGs old and new, Eastern and Western, big and small. I also run the Charlie and Dropouts podcast, which is a Final Fantasy XIV podcast, which I co-host. Sorry, I host it. My co-hosts are Victor Hunter and Mike Williams, my former partner in crime at US Gamer. And yes, please visit us at patreon.com/bloodgodpod.
Yeah.
And Victor is a friend of Retronauts, so it's keeping it in the family.
Absolutely.
Jason, how about you?
Hi. Well, you can find me at GamesBeat, where I write about RPGs and strategy games, along with running the crew of Dean, Mike, and Jeff. And, of course, you can always find me on Twitter at Jason_Wilson, all lowercase, where I just post a bunch of crap anymore.
Bunch of crap.
Everyone loves crap. All right. And finally, Frank.
If you're not familiar with the Video Game History Foundation, we are a charity dedicated to the preservation of video game history. We are at gamehistory.org. Cannot believe that domain was just floating around when I looked.
Wow.
Yeah. Gamehistory.org. We got that. But I think maybe a little bit more appropriate would be plugging a podcast that Kelsey Lewin and I do together. Kelsey's my co-director at the Video Game History Foundation. The podcast is called The Video Game History Hour. And the sort of premise of the show is that Kelsey and I struggled for years with people telling us we should do a podcast. And it's like, no, we're too... We are extreme perfectionists when it comes to the history, and like we want to teach history, but if we're going to do a podcast, each one's going to take like a month of research to do. And we realized other people do research. So each episode we bring on someone who has just published some cool video game history, something or other, a YouTube video, a documentary film, a book, an article, etc. And we have them tell us cool stories, and we kind of get into the process of how one does video game history, sort of the research process and interviewing people and stuff. And I think it's really good. So the Video Game History Hour, available wherever podcasts are available for the most part.
That's a much smarter approach than me researching an episode each week.
No research. I just got to read the article or whatever the night before.
Yeah, I felt so proud of myself with my video stuff because I saw Dr. Sparkle struggling with Crontendo and you know, just the volume of content that he creates for each episode. And I was like, what if I do it one game at a time?
Yeah, what if I do
like four or five games at a time?
Crontendo times 10.
Wow.
That's it.
To go so
we had Crontendo on, Dr. Yep. Sparkle, on one of our episodes.
And Kevin Bunch.
Kevin Bunch has probably been
on. Atari equivalent to that.
Yeah, he's probably been on the show at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, yeah. I don't know. Maybe we've probably had other Retronauts people. I'm not sure.
I believe so, yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, so yeah, check that out. And of course, check out more Retronauts, because we publish researched episodes every single week. Some weeks, there's two episodes, actually, but the second episode is a patron exclusive, because that is how we pay for this show to happen, so I can hang out in hotel rooms in person and talk to cool people about their memories of video game manuals.
And then spread them all over the bed.
That's right. It's a saucy podcast, folks. Anyway, Retronauts, you can support us. We are crowdfunded pretty much entirely. Go to patreon.com/retronauts, and for $3 a month, you get early access and high-quality output for every Monday episode. For $5 a month, you get those patron-exclusive episodes every other Friday, plus Discord access, plus weekly columns and mini-podcasts by Diamond Fight, detailing some interesting thing that happened 10, 15, 20, 30, 40 years ago that week in history. Great stuff. There's more than a year's worth of all that bonus content at this point, so there's a lot to work through. A lot of video game history. And the thing about history is that, at least so far, there just keeps being more of it. I hope it continues to be that way. And you can, of course, find me, Jeremy Parrish, on Twitter's GameSpite, doing stuff on my YouTube channel. It's called Jeremy Parrish. Doing stuff with Limited Run Games, and of course, doing stuff here on Retronauts. I don't know, maybe some other stuff. I can't remember what all I'm doing, but it's a lot, and I'm talking about video games a lot, and manuals, and reading about video games, and writing about them. It's fun, video games. I like them. Anyway, thanks again to Jeff Vlasic for supporting the show and giving us a cool topic to talk about. We'll be back again in a week, or is it in a few days? Oh, it is a few days. Our next topic will be a patron-exclusive episode about Skyrim. Yeah,
ooh.
It's a decade old.
Ah!